Welcome to the SSP podcast, and thanks to all 3,000 of you who listened to or downloaded the last one, and welcome to all of you who have just recently discovered us on iTunes. It's been great over the past few weeks watching our audience grow from a few hundred. The general election is well underway, and if you're lucky enough to have an SSP candidate, well, you know what to do. Remember, we are Scotland's party of the working class. We aren't funded by the Daily Express millions like UKIP or tax avoiders like the other main parties. When we make promises, if we are elected, we will deliver, just as we did when we were in the Scottish Parliament. Our manifesto was launched this week. I won't go through all the finer points of our manifesto. Others will do that later on in the podcast and in the next podcast on the 1st of May. But if you want to read what a radical manifesto that puts ordinary people in the driving seat rather than the corporations is like, just go to our website, www.scottishsocialistparty.org. And scroll down and read it for yourself. The headlines have been that Nicola, Natalie and Leanne have been teaching Ed and the Labour Party what progressive policies actually look like. And the Scottish Labour Party seem to be in disarray with disagreement with the Westminster mothership over just what their policies are. Here's a challenge to the SNP, the Greens, Labour, the Lib Dems, the Tories, etc. In Scotland, we have the wonderful live stream channels Indie Live and Democracy TV. What about a live streamed head-to-head with our spokespeople, the very capable Colin Fox and Sandra Webster? They will teach you what actual socialist, pro-working class, progressive policies really do look like. Contact us and we'll get it set up. Anyway, coming up, Colin Fox on the launch of the SSP manifesto this week, Don McKean on the upcoming American presidential election, podcaster Michael Greenwell in the first of a series of interviews he's doing for the SSP, Katie Bonner on the dreadful kidnapping of young women by Boko Haram in Nigeria, Stephanie Rowles on the Scottish service tax, and Callum Martin on the rebellion of 1820. As usual, the music this week is fantastic. Last week I gave details of Thief Action's new album. The week before that we gave details on the Orgreave Justice CD. And this week I have news of two great new socialist albums. Following their appearance on the left field stage at Glastonbury last year, Barnsley socialist punk band The Harriers have been causing quite a stir in socialist musical circles. Their manifesto, nothing less than contributing to the overthrow of the corrupt capitalist system through the power of song. Their new album, From Acorns Mighty Oaks, coming out on CD, vinyl and download on International Workers' Day, Friday the 1st of May, the same day as our next podcast. I've had a preview and all I can say is you need to buy this. These are The Harriers and this is Big Ideas and Promises.
To be. Aye, this week the Scottish Socialist Party launched its 2015 general election manifesto entitled For an Independent Socialist Scotland, Standing Up for Scotland's Working Class Majority. And we chose that title to show how distinct we are from the other parties that are standing. The SNP quite rightly claimed they're standing up for Scotland. Well, the Scottish Socialist Party, just as correctly, make clear we are standing up for Scotland's working class majority. And the launch of the manifesto, attended by the press, was a welcome opportunity for the Scottish Socialist Party to get our message and our manifesto and our programme out to a wider audience. And the general election, such as it is in Britain today, is a fascinating affair, because at UK level, this election is stuck in a stalemate between a coalition government that doesn't deserve to be re-elected because it's governed on behalf of a rich corporate elite that it believes it's untouchable and omnipotent, and on the other hand, an opposition so bereft of ideas that all it can do is ape the reactionary policies of the coalition on poverty and inequality, on austerity and cuts, on privatisation and attempting to scapegoat immigrants and claimants for a crisis they didn't cause. And of course, the majority of Britain's working class population who are engaged in this general election don't need to be reminded how they've suffered a substantial fall in their standard of living since 2010. We're £1,800 worse off than we were in 2010. Pay levels have deteriorated just as household bills have risen. And yet, the Tories and Labour say vote for them, re-elect them, and we can enjoy further austerity and cuts to public services and the standard of living and employment conditions that, quite frankly, our grandparents' generation wouldn't have tolerated for a centigram is for a £10 an hour living wage. Introduced now, not just the vote, but we changed our country completely. And it's quite clear that change has not only been profound, it's widespread. And people want to replace the Labour Party with something else, but something better. And the Scottish Socialist Party is that change, that better change. The Scottish Socialist Party offers a real change from more neoliberalism. We are offering a change that puts working class people's interests right and centre, which means that there's not going to be any cuts to jobs and public services, that we won't accept privatisation of the NHS, whether it's Labour or the SNP or the Tories that's behind it. Yes, I did say the SNP, because here in Edinburgh, the new sick children's hospital that's to be built adjacent to the new Royal Infirmary, Labour's PFI Royal Infirmary, well, the sick children's hospital here in Edinburgh, built by the SNP government, is to be a private hospital as well, under the Scottish Futures Trust. That's not good enough. You can't say you're protecting the NHS and then privatise the sick children's hospital. So the Scottish Socialist Party's credentials in protecting, upholding the principles the NHS were built upon, that the NHS is free to use when you need it, it's paid for out of general taxes, and it's owned by the people. Because that public ownership value and principle is central to what the Scottish Socialist Party stands for. We want to see the NHS 100% owned by the public. It's the most precious institution working class people in this country have, and we want to see that it stays that way. We also want to see our oil industry, gas and oil industry, returned to public hands. Our energy sector returned to public hands so we can eradicate the fuel poverty that stalks our nation. We want to see our railways returned to public hands. And of course, I say return because these were once publicly owned, privatised by Thatcher, privatised by Blair. We want them to be owned by the people because it's much more efficient and effective service provided in that way. That's how the Scottish Socialist Party's manifesto and programme stands in such contrast to the others. And the key question that voters across the country will be asking, of course, is how's that going to be paid for? How are we going to introduce a £10 an hour living wage? How are we going to build 100,000 houses for the socially rented sector? How are we going to give youngsters the opportunity for a better world? Well, The answer, as always, is that, of course, Britain is a rich country. Scotland is a rich country. The money's there. It's not a problem. We don't have to print it. We don't have to invent it. We have to redirect it. We have to take it from those who have and give it to those who need. We need to raise the top rate of tax. We need to raise corporation tax to 50 pence in the pound, modestly back to the level that it was when Thatcher was elected in 1979. We need to replace the unfair council tax with one based on your income and your ability to pay, where the rich begin to pay their share for a change. We need to introduce the Tobin tax on financial transactions, sometimes called the Robin Hood tax. And we would introduce a windfall tax on the top companies as part of our plan to return the wealth of this country and share it out much more evenly. That's the message that I'm delivering in Edinburgh South, that Sandra Webster, my colleague, is delivering in Paisley and Renfrewshire South, that Bill Bonner is delivering in Glasgow South West, and young Liam McLaughlin's delivering so well in Glasgow East. That's what's all soon.
Just Jones and Some Boys Are Bigger Than Others. Sorry for calling him the wrong name last time. The SSPF had a policy to replace the council tax with a much more fairer Scottish service tax for many years. The SNP promised this reform before they became the Scottish Government, but this seems to have slipped their minds. Next up, SSP member Stephanie Rowles gives a quick explanation on how our policy would be beneficial to all.
Scottish service tax. The fairer tax. The abolition of council tax in favour of a fairer, more viable tax is not a new idea. The Scottish Socialist Party have pushed for a change for many years, but to no avail. We have been opposed by Labour before, but now, with their unpopularity increasing in Scotland by the day, there may be light at the end of the tunnel. Other parties, including the SNP, have shown interest in changing from a land-based tax to an income-based tax. The regressive council tax currently in place pushes the working classes and low-income families further into poverty. For example, if you take a low-income family of four, where the mother has to choose between childcare or going back to work, while the father works a minimum wage job within a zero-hour contract, how, when the family's income is unstable, only working pay packet to pay packet, does the government expect the same outgoings each month? That could be a choice between paying the council tax and cutting back on food for a week. There is no choice, however. Sadly, the tax always wins. We believe a band system, much like the current council tax, but based on earnings rather than land or house value, would be much more beneficial to everyone, not just the working class. If you were to earn £15,000 a year, then only the £5,000 would be subject to tax of 4.5%. Anyone earning £10,000 or less would be exempt from the Scottish Service Tax. The total bill then would be £225 as opposed to £808.67 just for council tax, working based on the Band A in Glasgow. This figure does not include water charges or sewage charges. This figure then goes up to £1,086.89. As we can see, there is a large difference in this. Would everyone not benefit from a fairer system? Would it not be better for people to have a fairer form of tax which would allow them to avoid making the decision of whether to feed their family or to heat their home? The Scottish Service Tax may not be the perfect solution, but it certainly is in the right direction.
This is Roy Mahler on Zoo Vella's organ.
I work at a bar to fill your cup. I dip in the till to pick you up. I need somebody new to do for me like I do for you. Ooh, Zoo Vella's organ. Too easy to say good morning. Moments fly, moments stay. Who knows which ones will go which way? Zoo Vella's organ. Sings more hollow with every glass of Beaujolais I swallow. I need somebody new to do for me like I do for you. What's your problem? Ooh, so feel a sorghum. Two even say good morning. Exhibit A, the corner B, blues come tumbling down on me. So feel a sorghum.
Michael Greenwell from the Scottish Independence podcast, and this is the first of a couple of little interviews. The first one talking about the left-wing case for leaving the European Union, and the second one talking about the left-wing case for staying in the European Union. So for this first one, I spoke to Neil Davidson. Neil is an academic at the University of Glasgow, is involved in the Radical Independence campaign, and is also the author of the award-winning book Discovering the Scottish Revolution. We spoke about how Neil sees the left-wing case for leaving the European Union and why it's important not to leave opposition to the European Union to the right-wing nuts. Hope you enjoy it. Hi Neil, how's it going?
Hi Mike, how are you?
I'm very good. I'm a bit under the weather. But why I asked you on here is that when we talked about this before, you said a very telling phrase that we can't let the right dominate the anti-EU message. So would you like to expand on that for us?
Yeah, I think it's partly because we're having some discussions with other socialists, and the question of UKIP and the Tory right comes up quite often. And because obviously the whole raison d'etre of UKIP is to oppose the EU and argue for its withdrawal, and obviously they have some allies in the right of the Tory party as well. There's a kind of way in which people on the left sometimes go, well, if they're opposed to the EU, we have to support it, or at least we can't argue for withdrawing from it, or otherwise you're kind of capitulating to UKIP in a hard right position. And my view is you can't start from there. It's like that's a tail wagging the dog kind of position. You can't simply say, well, hard right people oppose the EU, therefore we've got to do the same. It's perfectly good left-wing reasons for opposing the EU.
Yeah, the enemy of my enemy, not always my friend.
Absolutely. And I think that the starting point has to be, what does the British capitalist class want in its majority? What's the actual big battalions of British capital want? That's the starting point, not with the nutcases who read the Daily Express and who have very small capital, you know, what do they want, which is basically what UKIP represents. And if you look at the kind of big capitalists in Britain, they all want to stay in the EU. I mean, they may want to renegotiate the treaty, and some of them certainly do want to do that, but by and large, they want to stay in it. So if they want to stay in it, clearly that's the kind of, these people are our main enemies. Not, you know, I mean, obviously opposed to UKIP and another faction of the fascist ones, but I don't think you start from their position, you start from the position of British capital, and they are in favour of the EU, which is not that surprising, since it's a project which is actually geared towards, I think, imposing a neoliberal agenda.
Was it always like that?
No, I think one of the things about it is it's tended to shift the way that capitalism itself has changed. So when the EU was set up, originally just the things that led up to the common market, in the 40s and 50s, it was pretty liberal, social democratic in tone, and of course was part of the Cold War. I mean, the Americans helped to set up the project as a kind of bulwark against Russia and the Stalinist regimes in the East. So it's kind of shifted in character. It's a bit chameleon-like. It shifts in character according to what kind of phase of capitalism we're in. But it clearly has shifted much more to the right, well, certainly since the 80s, and the adoption of policies which are, you know, would see as hard neoliberal policies. I think that was a bit hidden for a while, particularly in the late 80s, with the kind of social agenda of Europe. Delors coming over here and speaking to the DUC and so on, and people seeing that as a kind of way of maybe fending off some of the worst excesses of Thatcherism. But actually, I think that was an illusion. I think that was always a very small part of the whole project, but it was one that was used to sell it, if you like, to the Labour movement and to the socialist parties.
And at the beginning, there was also the kind of element where, in a certain sense, it was a money trap. I remember talking about this with someone before. When certain policies were introduced, they introduced a way that there was a form of protectionism. So if an American company wanted to sell cars in Europe, for example, they would build the factory in Europe to avoid the protectionism. So it was a way of kind of locking jobs and money in. Which is not necessarily a bad thing. But now with TTIP and other of the financial measures, that seems to be becoming more and more diluted.
Yeah, and I think that's partly what I was talking about, the kind of way in which those kind of, if you like, state capitalist measures and protectionist measures were built into the project originally, because that was how, to a large extent, the economy operated in the 50s and 60s. But that's actually changed. And I mean, if you look at the relationship with America, then it's always been like a tense one. Initially, the Americans helped set it up because they wanted a capitalist Europe to defend against the East. But at the same time, the EU saw itself as being, you know, distinct from America and wanting to pitch itself as a rival for international markets. And in fact, the 1957 treaty, which the Treaty of Rome, which in a sense is one of the founding documents, in a sense was established because of America asserting its hegemony in the Middle East after Suez, which of course the French had been involved in as well as the British, in the sense of we're going to establish ourselves as an alternative, a kind of ally of America, but also a competitor. Now, of course, as the whole world economy has slid towards neoliberalism, and slid has been pushed towards neoliberalism, starting from the UK and the USA, the EU's gone along with that. It's shifted its practices to kind of adapt to the kind of neoliberal environment. One thing I think that's not often noticed, and the Conservatives certainly aren't keen to promote this, but actually Thatcher herself was one of the main instigators in actually pushing the EU towards the kind of neoliberal positions in the mid-80s. With the support of Mitterrand and Delors at the time, you know, so the idea that we never intervened in Europe, it's always been some terrible imposition on Britain, is simply not true. I mean, actually, that certainly in 1986, I would say, there were a lot of the policies adopted from that point on in particular, and were very much influenced by Thatcher, by deregulation, especially of financial services, by putting limits on social spending. In a way, you could see that some of the European politicians, particularly in Germany, were quite keen to go down that road anyway. But they used, you know, they allowed Thatcher to kind of make the arguments that they then picked up. So the actual relationship between neoliberalism in Britain and in Europe is much more complex than people think sometimes. And of course, that whole history has now been rewritten by the Tory party to make it look as if they were always fighting the terrible Europeans who were trying to impose things on Britain. But in fact, it hasn't been like that at all.
But isn't that something that all politicians do? Grandstanding against the EU is a way of sort of gaining domestic support. Though I'm sure the French and German politicians do it when they need a quick jump in the polls.
Oh yeah, and partly it's to do with the kind of balance of power within the EU. I mean, originally it was very much a kind of French-German show. The French doing the diplomatic stuff, the Germans doing the heavy economic development, and the Italians sort of propping up the French, really. Those are the three big players, with France and Germany very much ahead of everybody else. But latterly, and certainly since 1989, certainly since the fall of Eastern European regimes and the reunification of Germany, Germany has very much emerged as the dominant figure. Now, that means that people often badmouth Germany, but even though Germany, its positions are ones that are accepted by everybody, but it allows the Germans to carry the blows from people who are protesting about particular policies, because they are obviously the dominant force now, which they weren't always, but certainly from the 90s they've become that. In the case of the Tories, I think it's interesting because they kind of created a monster that they can't control. After the fall of the Stalinist regimes in Eastern Europe, they almost had to have an enemy that they could, you know, whip up hatred and fear about, and the EU ludicrously became this for a while until Islam took over from it. So they brought this all the EU as this terrible, you know, socialist conspiracy and so on. You know, Thatcher saying we didn't defeat socialism in Eastern Europe, have reimposed by Delors, as if Delors had any such intention. So they put up this fear of the EU, but then takes on a life of its own. So that people in the right, the very Tory party is generally very right wing, but it's far right, if you like, and in UKIP, actually take this seriously and argue hard against the EU, but now it's out of control. I mean, the possibility may well happen that there is actually a referendum and that Britain does actually leave, which would be against the interests of British capitalism, all right, but they may end up having to do it because they're kind of, they've whipped up so much hatred and so much nationalist frenzy about Europe that actually that's an outcome which is unintended, if you like. So these things have consequences, not necessarily the ones that the politicians thought they were aiming for.
So what would be the socialist case for actually leaving it? I'll give you one for a starter and then we'll see where it develops. Because, you could talk about maybe the undemocratic nature of it.
Well, that's obviously the case. It's never been a democratic institution. The parliament is obviously the least important of any of the major institutions of the EU. Not just because it lacks democratic legitimacy, the very low votes and so on, but it simply doesn't decide most of the major policy decisions. These are taken by the Commission, Council of Ministers, by the Economic and Financial Council, and by, of course, the European Central Bank, which is absolutely integrated into this entire process. Now, these are not democratic institutions, and it's difficult to see how you could actually make them democratic. But more than that, it's the controls which the EU has on any kind of social democratic, not only socialist, but just even social democratic policy making, are actually fairly severe, from the Maastricht Convergence Criteria and the Stability and Growth Pact. Both impose incredible controls on what people can do in terms of inflation, in terms of interest rates, exchange rates, the maximum taxation rates you can have. You can't spend more than 3% of GDP at any point. I mean, these are real restrictions. And if you got a government of the left in Scotland or in Britain, then actually, if you stay in the EU, you're severely constrained on what you could do, even in fairly, you know, moderate social democratic kind of policies. So that's a major stumbling block. And you can only see what's happening to Greece to see in extremity what they would do, you know, to a country that's been tortured for years. And, okay, it's in the euro. But nevertheless, that's the attitude of the EU towards a kind of state that seemed to be misbehaving in some way, is to stick the boot in ferociously. And that would have impact even people who weren't actually signed up for the euro. So it's a mechanism for imposing neoliberal type of policies. And there's no way you can really get out of that while you're tied into its structures. That's the main reason. I think that there are problems if you leave it. There's no point in pretending these don't exist. But there are also far greater problems than like staying. And I think the problem really is that people, but who's going to be the first person to sort of, which is the first country to actually say this and to break? It may well still be Greece, incidentally, but I don't think that's decided yet. But to me, it's just like if you're maintaining yourself within the structure, you're simply tying your hands in terms of what you can do. And that means you're starting off from a position of saying, well, I can't do any of the things that even, you know, Labour governments in the 1960s would have been able to do because of the constraints that have been brought in.
So being part of the European Union locks us out of a lot of our decision-making process. in that sense that the right-wing critique has some validity. It's just where they want to go with it that's the problem.
Well, the right-wing critique is, in a sense, I mean, formally, that's right. But, I mean, the right-wing position would basically be to see Britain tie itself to the United States more firmly rather than the EU. I don't think there's any particular difference in the policies they want to impose, I mean, in terms of the hard-right position. I mean, they're all tied up with international capital, and they're ferociously racist and all the rest of it. But, of course, the EU itself is, you know, Fortress Europe is a massive barrier to people migrating into it from outside the EU's own territory, and it stops them quite ruthlessly. You know, so it's not as if it's a sort of a marvellous liberal institution compared to the rest of UKIP. It's just the territorial area in which these controls are imposed is different from Europe than it would be for an individual nation state. So I think that we have to reject them as simply being hypocritical about this, even when they're not just completely deranged. I mean, as far as UKIP are concerned, their main social base isn't, as is sometimes claimed, the working class. It's small employers, the kind of bit where the petty bourgeoisie meet the very small capitalists. Now, these people are affected by EU rules and regulations to a far greater extent than big multinationals are, which is why they rail against them. But what they want to do is restore absolute freedom of manoeuvre against trade unions, against health and safety regulations, and so on as well. So that's quite different from our left position, I think. It's one that we don't have anything in common with.
Absolutely. And just to sort of finish up on that, from a left-wing perspective, you mentioned some of the things earlier, but what 3, 4, or 5 things could we do by leaving the EU that we simply cannot do by staying in?
Well, for one thing, you'd be able to tax rich people far more than you currently can, because the rates are currently constrained by I think it's the Maastricht convergence criteria, actually. So you could do that. And I mean, at the moment, there are just limits to what you can do. There's also limits to how much you can spend, how much you can borrow. We can do all those things. We don't have to remain fixated on maintaining low inflation. In fact, inflation. We're currently in a deflationary situation anyway, but that's not been engineered by anybody. And you could set interest rates at different levels. So I mean, these are all just tools that are basic for running any economy, which are bound by the EU at the moment. But since you're much more beyond that, and these are just the kind of basic set of instruments you would have, is you'd be able to say that you're trying to forge a kind of path that's not tied in with the whole neoliberal project. And which is not dominated by the way Germany currently dominates this and basically asserts what's going to happen over large parts of the EU. That, I think, would allow you then to cooperate with other states that have broken from the EU or had not been in it in the first place to try and establish a different kind of set of alliances that weren't constructed on a neoliberal basis, but hopefully a socialist basis, but at least a social democratic basis, which actually puts the kind of needs of the people before the needs of banks, financial institutions and multinational corporations. I simply don't think you can do that, or you'd come under enormous pressures if you attempted to do it externally. It allows you a bit of freedom. We shouldn't pretend it would be easy. You know, it's not like it's a magic wand you can wave. Leaving the EU is going to allow you to do anything. You would still have to take on your own capitalist class, your own ruling class, you know, and huge battles would be ahead there. But nevertheless, I think it would be a kind of sign of intention, and also would free up your hands to do certain things you can't do at the moment. And I think that there are a number of states, I think, in Europe, integrated in different degrees into the EU, which are looking and possibly hoping someone makes a break, and people are probably expecting it to be Greece, that allows that kind of alliances to begin to be built. Then the whole thing would begin to unravel, and I think that can't come soon enough.
Just as a wee last wee thing, what about the situation of sort of Norway, where they've kind of got one foot in and one foot out of it? They seem to take the bits they want, but don't bother with the bits they don't like.
I think it's possibly that Norway's allowed to do this because no one really cares very much what it does one way or the other. I mean, you know, Norway's a stable state. It does, you know, it abides by the rules. You know, it's tended to line up with Germany, whereas Italy and so on tend to line up behind France in terms of its overall direction. But I think they can allow that in one or two cases in order to keep them on board. Britain would be a totally different thing. And certainly the kind of states that are clearly in major problems, like Greece and I think Spain as well, would not be allowed to flout the rules because they'd be seen getting away with it. Norway hasn't done anything like that, so it's in a sense it's allowed to get away with these things. But it's marginal. You know, these are states on the margins of it, which don't fundamentally affect the whole project. If it felt like it was actually going to do something that would seriously undermine the EU project, I'm sure they'd begin to start being much stricter about what they couldn't do.
Okay, thanks very much for speaking to us, Neil.
Okay, thank you.
So there you go, hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back soon with an interview that makes the left-wing case for staying in the European Union to give a little balance to the thing. Speak to you next time.
Thanks, Michael, and I look forward to the next interview. This is Thief Action from their upcoming album, Reading Writing Revolution. This is Socialism, Utopian and Scientific.
Prussia's greatest love machine, young Hegelian at 19, only came in to check our position. Now the plea is not his only position. Got inside in on expropriation, working against the Sicilian mission. Yeah, I'm loving Engels instead. We want the bakery, now just the bread. To every mouth and mind is fed. I'm loving Engels instead. Output prolific, output terrific. No utopian, it gets in scientific.
The origins of the commodities and class hate, the history of the money trick, it's the empowerment of the rich.
Now the vote won't set you free, while y'all still stake the property.
One year since the world was gripped by the kidnap of 219 girls in northern Nigeria by the group Boko Haram. This time last year, a group of militants attacked the government girls' secondary school in Chibok, Nigeria. Boko Haram are particularly opposed to Western-style model education, especially the education of girls. They hold the belief that it lures people away from the traditional Islamic teaching as a way of life. Since 2010, they have been attacking students throughout the region. The group first emerged a number of years ago with the aim of creating an Islamic state in some of Nigeria's northern provinces. The breakdown of government authority in these provinces has created a vacuum in which such groups have thrived. This has been accelerated by the collapse of the Gaddafi regime in Libya. The West's intervention in Libya led to the collapse of the state and the destabilisation of the whole region. Huge free zones with no central controls have been created, which has allowed groups like Boko Haram to move freely between states. It should be pointed out that Boko Haram are in fact one player among a variety in this area. Others include tribal and regional groups, as well as disaffected elements of the armed forces. The government's response has been to try and defeat the rebels militarily, but this so far has failed. Military action does not work because it doesn't tackle the reasons why groups like Boko Haram rise to prominence in the first place. It is deeply reactionary. Nigeria is a country with immense divisions between health, wealth and poverty, with a country governed by a corrupt, rich elite. Poorer regions like those in the north have suffered decades of underdevelopment, as most of the resources have been concentrated in the wealthier south. Although Nigeria is currently ruled by a civilian government, for most of its history it has been ruled by military dictatorships, and even today, the army plays a key role. The way to defeat groups like Boko Haram is to tackle issues like poverty, inequality and underdevelopment. This means having a government in Abuja which tackles corruption, redistributes wealth and is engaged in genuine nation building. A good example of how much the country has come out for development took place in 2012 with a strike. Despite being an oil-rich country, the government increased oil prices for the benefit of private companies rather than people. Many people do not have a basic electricity supply in Nigeria and need to buy cheap fuel to power their homes. They could not afford to pay the new inflated prices. During the strike, there were no attacks by Boko Haram. Christian strikers worked with and protected Muslim strikers and vice versa. This highlights that people are willing to work together in Nigeria to oppose the corrupt government and are crying out for basic living standards. The kidnapping of the schoolgirls highlights a wider problem of the treatment of women in Nigerian society. Although the girls from middle-class families enjoy similar standards of women in Europe in terms of wealth and education, the vast majority, Christian and Muslim, suffer entrenched discrimination. What is promoting the development of women in some respects is urbanisation, which has broken down a lot of traditional restrictions on women. This, more than anything else, promotes a women's agenda in Nigeria and feeling the demand for more access to education, better healthcare and civil rights.
This is the brilliant Steve White and the Protest Family and Bad Day for Bojo.
May Johnson is not a man who cares much for promises or for ticket offices or passengers or staff. He wants to axe 1,000 jobs, 1,000 livelihoods he'll rob while ruffling his hair. Oh my, he's such a laugh. But it's a bad day for Bojo, it's a good day for Bob Crow. The underground workers have all gone on strike. It's a good day for Bob Crow, it's a bad day for Bozo. He best get on his Bugs Barkley's bike. He wants to close the ticket office. I read it in the Daily Boris. Replace it with a Costa coffee. Must be off his head. And he's attacked the workers' right to say enough to go on strike. Let's have a ballot about the mayor instead. Cos it's a bad day for Bojo, it's a good day for Bob Crow. The underground workers have all gone on strike. It's a good day for Bob Crow, it's a bad day for Bozo. He best get on his bollocks, Barclays by banjo. There's a moral to this story, and it's one we've told before. You vote for someone funny, they'll act above the law. So if you think the mayor is crazy, you wanna ride the tube in safety, join a picket line and show Bozo the door. Cos it's a bad day for Bojo, it's a good day for Bob Crow. The underground workers have all gone on strike. It's a good day for Bob Crow, it's a bad day for Bozo. He'd best get on his bollocks, Barclays bike. Yes, he'd best get on his bollocks, Barclays bike.
Coming up, Callum Martin with his regular history slot and Don McKean on the American election. As I've said, I have news about the launch of two albums. This week sees the launch of the new The Concerned Citizens, or The CCs for short, new album. If you go to the podcast website, sspcampsy.podbean.com, you'll find a link to where you can buy the album, Solution Songs, buy it, and buy the Hurriers album. And then you'll know how to vote in the general election by the time you've listened to them. That is, to get rid of the Westminster Condemn Chaos Coalition, who have done all they can to wreck our public services and people's lives. Anyway, this is the title track, Solution Songs.
Politicians perspire, but never fight in the street. I've seen them fall on the line, but never lose their conceit. I know you are better, because you admire the truth. I don't celebrate war, but I know those who fought were the vanguard of the brave. And despite what I'm taught, I remember their pain. They want us our welfare state. We will sing when the facts are wrong. We will bring the folks along. We need none. none of your protest songs. We will sing solution songs, sing along. To stand in the way, the fascists will rise and steal the day. It's up to the righteous to stand. Police don't know their rights from wrongs. They have pushed us round too long. We want peace, jobs, bread, land we know where from. So we will sing solution songs in a long. Folks along, we need none of your protest songs. We will sing solution songs, sing along.
In the 1790s, the Society of United Scotsmen had represented a rallying point for the forces of reform and revolution and set forth a clear programme for Scotland. They had sought to repeal the Treaty of Union of 1707 and to establish an independent Scottish Republic, a republic that would be founded on democratic and egalitarian principles, with the egalitarian and democratising traditions that emanated out of the Church of Scotland's Presbyterian principles. Much of Scotland, especially around the southwest and central belt, had begun to agitate. Yet, as we saw last week in the 1790s, the Scottish upper establishment of the British state were largely successful in their attempts to quash the movement's momentum. They did not manage, however, to put an end to those ideas. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian Scottish Socialist Party, and welcome to Making the Flag Red, a series looking at the history behind the struggles towards democracy and socialism. This week we're looking at what happened to those ideas touted of such promise in the 1790s by moving forward to just after the end of the Napoleonic Wars and taking an introductory look at the Radical War of 1820, also known as the Scottish Insurrection of 1820. For whilst the Society of United Scotsmen had been driven underground, and much of their leadership arrested or dispersed, the ideas that they had found had continued to thrive underground. The context of the Napoleonic Wars had kept many of these ideas on a back burner, but after the wars ended in 1815, political and economic questions began to reappear to give these ideas a new lease of life. Major economic downturns set in after the war ended. Wartime industries that had provided employment in a range of areas, from kelp gathering to industrial military workshops, began to close down. And at the same time, clearances in the Highlands had begun, and with soldiers and sailors en masse facing demobilisation, unemployment rose and wages fell. The Corn Laws, a major political issue of the day, meanwhile, kept food prices high by imposing substantial tariffs on the import of corn and many other grains. The result was a growing period of unrest. Artisan workers across the British Isles were in widespread unrest, but in Scotland it was weavers in particular who led much of the agitation. In areas such as Paisley and Renfrewshire, for example, there is a long tradition of radicalism that stems through much of this period. An understanding for this can be seen in the processes of the Industrial Revolution itself. The industrialisation of the weaving industry into large factory mills, dominated and controlled by excessively wealthy mill owners, helped to foster a sense that change was pressingly needed and that economic and political conflict between the rich elite and those that they sought to exploit was increasingly inevitable. Now, in August of 1819 in Manchester, an event known as the Peterloo Massacre had taken place. The Peterloo Massacre saw local yeoman militia cavalry attack a crowd gathered for a reform rally, killing at least 15 people and injuring several hundred more. That September 1819, it was decided in Paisley to hold a memorial for those who had been killed and injured in the Peterloo Massacre. And ultimately, it took a week for cavalry units to restore the status quo, with an estimated 5,000 people giving voice to their discontent by turning to rioting. The response across Scotland was immense. With Peterloo in mind and events in Paisley bringing matters home somewhat, across Ayrshire, Renfrewshire, Fife and many other parts of the country, further protest meetings began to be held and organised. In the early 1820, therefore, the reform movement established a secret 28-man committee for the purpose of forming a provisional government. The plan? To take up arms, seize power in Scotland, and establish an independent Scottish Republic, ending the Union and establishing the Parliament of the New Republic in Edinburgh. From early on, though, the Crown Government and the Scottish upper establishment was determined to fight back. From early on, the movement appears to have been saturated with spies and agent provocateurs, constantly giving the government information on the activities of the radicals. Through these actions, the committee for the provisional government was for the most part caught and arrested whilst meeting in Glasgow on the 21st of March 1820. This didn't put an end to the movement, however, and the very next day, plans for continuing the rising seemed to have been drawn up at meetings in Glasgow Green and in Rutherglen. By Saturday the 1st of April, the proclamation of the committee that it was time to take arms was collected from printers, and by the 2nd of April had begun to appear across Glasgow. Now, by Monday the 3rd of April, strikes and unrest involving an estimated 60,000 people had spread across Lanarkshire, Ayrshire, Dumbartonshire, Renfrewshire, out towards Stirlingshire and more. Across many towns, people in groups of 10s, 20s, 30s, even as many as 200 in Balfron, began to take arms, improvising pikes and seizing weaponry alongside pistols, muskets, grenades, anything that could be found really. In one or two instances, we've seen reports of javelins being made to help take on cavalry forces. Now, Crown forces across Scotland began to react to this, trying to break up and disperse gathering strikers and radicals before they could take arms and properly prepare. In Kilbracken, for example, the town where Mary Barber would grow up nearly a century later, soldiers too dispersed people making rudimentary pikes. Paisley, meanwhile, was forced under a military curfew. In Glasgow, there seems to have been brief, if largely uneventful and casualty-free, skirmishing between radical forces gathering around the edges of the city and Crown regiments stationed within. Over the next few days, the radicals made several uncoordinated attempts to seize the Carron Ironworks in Falkirk, each time being dispersed by cavalry and yeomanry. Four armed radicals, for example, were injured in a small clash at Bonnymuir near Stirling on the 4th of April as a last serious attempt was made to seize the ironworks. The following day, a small band under arms began to move from Strathaven towards East Kilbride under the famous Scotland Free or Desert banner, but they too were broken up and arrested. Between these actions, many of the leaders of the movement were captured, arrested variously, or in some cases even injured in the fighting. But as the days passed on, it became clear the moment had well and truly passed. Thwarted constantly by government agents and lack of coordination, small pockets of radicals began to continue to agitate on both the east and west coasts, whilst in many places folk did continue to make arms and drill for battle, but without control of the Carron Ironworks, and with royal soldiers controlling not just Glasgow and the major cities of the west, but increasingly moving outwards into the towns surrounding, it was clear that any prospect of a rising making serious strides was over. The rising soon dispersed, arrests were made, and 88 men were charged with treason. Many were convicted and variously executed or transported to Australia. It would be some time before any thought was given to a rising again. There was also a consequent response from the government, however. When the Great Reform Act of 1832 came, the first visible stride towards reforming Westminster, Scotland began to gain greater representation. Jobs were created for unemployed weavers by the building of Radical Road, built for that very purpose, the track that leads across the face of Salisbury Crags in Edinburgh. Indeed, it has been suggested that the rising gave a much greater sense of urgency to pleas being made to the Crown to pay greater attention to Scotland, attention which would result in the, some would say, fateful visit of King George IV to Scotland in 1822. Now, this visit seems to, in some sense, have been conducted with the specific intention of fostering a new relationship between the Scottish people at large and the King, a visit which incidentally would result in the popularisation of tartan and Highland wear with the Scottish, and indeed the British aristocracies, as part of this process. The rising, meanwhile, may have failed, but its legacy is immense. face rising for a Scottish Republic which aims to defeat not only the British state, but also to replace, overthrow the upper crust of the Scottish establishment in the name of democracy and egalitarianism was not an isolated event plucked from random, but rather it's just one episode in a much longer story. Indeed, the principles they fought for survive down to the present day. The torch the Scottish Socialist Party carries now burns with the same flame and spirit they carried then. Indeed, we are not isolated in history ourselves, and with SSP election campaigns well underway for 2015 and under preparation for crucial elections in 2016, I dare say we may well find ourselves making a certain degree of history too. Next week, however, we'll be continuing to move forwards through this period of Scottish history, and over the next few weeks we'll be giving attention to both the start of the Chartist movement, but also to a contextual overview of the changing governments and shifting situation in Westminster through the first part of the 19th century. Until then, I've been Callum Martin. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Callum. Remember, get in touch with us via the website www.scottishsocialistparty.org or email direct neilwscott@hotmail.com. We want to know your views on our policies, the podcast, and I'm wanting to hear from unsigned and independent bands who would like to have their music played on Scotland's most popular socialist podcast. Another election countdown has started, 2 years to go to the American presidential elections, and the candidates have bolted from the traps. In a moment, you'll hear SSP member Don McKean with his view on what's happening in the US, after which the title track from David Rovick's album, When I'm Elected President. If you haven't heard of David Rovick's, please look him up. Next podcast is our pre-election one on May Day. I'll speak to you then.
Everyone's favorite popularity contest is coming up again, and that's, of course, the American presidential election. It looks like Hillary Clinton will be the Democrats' choice this time, and there's been a lot of debate and discussion what this will mean, how important is it. As with Obama, it would be important. It would be a barrier to break through. First time the Democrats have ever nominated a woman, which is surprising for a party which claims to be progressive. And it would be an important step forward, as with Obama, but of course it's a symbolic victory, and symbolic victories don't really have the sort of impact that everybody kind of hopes that they would. It was important that John F. Kennedy was elected at the time, not because he later showed himself to be a progressive candidate. He wasn't. He escalated the war in Vietnam. He turned his back on the civil rights movement. It was Lyndon Johnson who got the civil rights legislation we think of through after Kennedy was assassinated. But the important thing was that at the time, anti-Catholic prejudice was much stronger in the United States than it is now. The KKK, one of their targets alongside blacks and Jews, was Catholics. And there were people at the time like the commentator Norman Vincent Peale who worried that Kennedy would be a tool of the Vatican. So, you know, once Kennedy becomes president, that then allayed a lot of people's fears, and people can then kind of move on. However, how much further have we moved on with Obama being president? Maybe the whole Black Lives Matter movement is getting the attention it's getting because there is an African-American president. Maybe it's just that the ridiculous numbers of black people who are shot by the police in the United States, it's just become so outrageous people can't ignore it anymore. In any case, whoever the president is going to be, the most important thing is, what are people doing? Are people organized? The biggest problem that the United States has is that there is no organized anti-capitalist party. There's nobody who could stand for election, even knowing that they're not going to win, who could get a national platform or even a regional platform to say that that there is an argument, that there is an alternative other than the neoliberal agenda that people like Hillary Clinton have always backed. There are breakthroughs here and there. There's the senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who's openly socialist. There's a socialist on the city council in Seattle. But these arguments are really almost invisible for most Americans. There was that breakthrough in the 1960s of progressive politics, but again, because the new left was not organized in the same way as the old left, they didn't organize around political parties, and we still have regular bursts of activity around certain issues, like in the 1980s, people were organized against fighting America's wars in Latin America in the 1990s against the World Trade Organization and then the Occupy movement. But unfortunately, every time one of these movements ends, there's nowhere else for people to go. And if there aren't organized movements, anti-capitalist movements, let alone socialist movements, because in the United States that's a tough one to pursue. But it means that so-called progressive Democrats can still push all of their attacks on welfare, still push privatization, still push imperialist wars, and there's nobody to really challenge them. And there's nobody to make a better case. So, hopefully, at some point in the future in the United States, the organization, or the organizing that has to happen, will happen. Because if not, we will have a continuing transfer, as we've had since the 70s and 80s onwards, of the social wealth to a tiny number of people at the top. The situation is disastrous for Americans, and due to America's influence around the world, it's a disaster for the rest of us too.
When I'm elected president, the first thing that I'll do, nationalize all the banks and give all the money to you. Raise taxes on the rich until there are no rich anymore. My government's first priority will be winning the class war. When I'm elected president, I'll make housing a human right. With a party in control of the Congress, that won't be a difficult fight. Folks can move out from under the bridges into the vacation homes of the gentry. There will be no hungry children, not in my 21st century. When I'm elected president, we will modernize the country. Solar panels on every rooftop, windmills in every county. Flat Earth Society members will have to see that the world is round. Coal, oil, uranium will all have to stay underground. When I'm elected president, drug prohibition will end. The livelihood of towns no longer will depend on jailing millions for the crime of getting high, on imprisoning the poor for trying to get by. When I'm elected president, we'll use old tanks for flower pots. Turn West Point into a garden, we'll call it an anarchist plot. We'll bring all the soldiers home, put them to work building railways. The peace of my government's transition plan will inspire enemies. When I'm elected president, we'll turn the country on its face. When my government gets going, you won't recognize the place. Ecotopian equality we start building in November, when election day comes round. You just remember, when I'm elected president,